pleased to have David Camito with us this morning. David is a dean at JFK University, where he also teaches. He is also a scholar of Buddhism. He just recently published a book, Nagarjuna's 70 Stanzas. He translated the book and wrote an introduction and oversaw the whole commentary on it. David is a practicing student of Taratoku Rinpoche, who's in the Bay Area recently. And David is also continuing to help our Zen centers integrate Taratoku's teaching by going on a regular basis to San Francisco Zen Center and working, helping to work out a curriculum of Buddhist study.
That's more than enough.
A lot more that could be said.
That's more than enough. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you for having me here in this wonderful hall that is so nondescript on the outside and so utterly beautiful on the inside. It's truly a pleasure to be here. When Mei Li called me, she asked what I might speak on, when I speak about this book that she mentioned, and I said, well, no, that's actually kind of boring to me at this point. I mean, I spent so many years working with that I didn't really too much want to talk about it. And there are other things that were really kind of exciting for me at the moment, and that I'd rather share that excitement. But it turns out that whatever it is that happens for us in the past refuses to just stay in the past. It keeps creeping into the present. As I thought about what I might want to speak about, the past crept into the present, and this many years of my life working on this book crept into what I wanted to speak about. The place for me really to start is with something that's happening this evening, something that is probably the most exciting thing going on in my life right now. My wife is an artist, and she's had a group of friends over the years who have painted in a style sometimes called visionary, sometimes called surrealist. And we've been getting together every couple of weeks to drink a little wine, have some conversation, and work on a little project, which is along the lines of 22 artists trying to paint together and independently what worlds in harmony would look like. A conference that's happening in Los Angeles in October of 1989. This conference will be keynoted by His Holiness the Dalai Lama. We'll bring together many psychologists from the West, practitioners from the East. And the idea that we had of trying to bring together people who could somehow communicate what harmony was about, what worlds in harmony was about, was an idea that grew out of what I learned in working on this book. Now, to go from visionary art to Buddhist thought and back again may seem like a long and circuitous trip, but one really naturally grew out of the other. And that's what I'd like to speak about today. Hopefully briefly, as a university professor, who knows, that may not be possible, but I'd give that a try. The thing that really has struck me in the last several years, and that as much as anything has motivated this project and this concern about the interweaving that I spoke briefly of, is a repeated feeling over and over again as I talk to people all over the Bay Area, read in the media, listen to Bill Moyers on TV interviewing Noam Chomsky, of all people, that obviously the world is in a certain kind of a mess, and people are really wanting to do something about it, trying to analyze the source of the problem, what can be done, how do we go forward, how did we get in this mess, how do we get out of this mess. On so many levels, whether we're talking about nuclear war, pollution of the environment, traffic on the Bay Bridge, I mean, it's over and over and over again, but to me it's all the same problem. The same problem being that our wrong thinking and our wrong understanding of what's going on around us has brought us as human beings and the planet to a very extraordinary state of affairs, a turning point of utter significance. Last night, Noam Chomsky, in speaking to Bill Moyer, said, as far as he was concerned, that our generation had to make some decisions and do something, or we would have no world at all to bequeath to our children and our grandchildren. And he wasn't kidding. He was quite serious. I think he caught Moyer's back a little bit, but I just heard another voice saying the same thing again that I've been hearing all over the Bay Area. But what was interesting about Chomsky was, from his point of view as a linguist, he was really saying, we created this mess because of the way we've been thinking about things, and as a result, the way we've been acting. And it was almost like hearing a Buddhist speaking, because when I look into the Dharma, especially as I look into Madhyamaka, as taught by Nagarjuna, as transmitted by the Tibetans, that's what I hear them saying. The source of all the problems we as human beings find for ourselves is something that can be traced, or the source, shouldn't say that, that the source of all of our problems is our wrong understanding of the truth of things about us. The truth of things about us, i.e. around us, and the truth of things about us, who we are and what we are. And as long as we don't understand correctly, we'll continue to act incorrectly. And the mess that we're in is a logical outcome of that. As the Buddha said, the source of all suffering is ignorance. And the essential bit of ignorance is wrong understanding about selfhood, wrong understanding about our nature as selves or as beings, and wrong understanding about the phenomena around us that we incorrectly identify. The whole thrust of Nagarjuna's teaching was to try and develop an understanding, a correct understanding, of what is around us, and who we are, and what we are, and how we function, so we can function properly. Now, as a student, I thought about that early on in my life very much as an individualistic concern. If I could understand who I was and how I functioned, I could make things better for me. Well, as I got farther and farther into learning, and farther into the Dharma, I discovered that that was an essential piece of wrong understanding, that I was merely concerned about myself, and I was perpetuating those kinds of concerns about myself. And in doing so, I wasn't going to help myself. I wasn't going to help anybody else. And as I began penetrating farther and farther into Buddhist teachings about the self and about selflessness, teachings usually called emptiness, teachings about emptiness or shunyata, I began to see that the essential point, really, was not to focus on this concept of I as something that desired and I as something that wanted, but to penetrate beyond that, to penetrate to what my own deepest nature was and the deepest nature of everyone. This is a subject that gets very profound and very deep, and it's easily something that we can get lost in. And I fear that if we progress along the path that I'm starting to go, that we will get thoroughly lost and not be able to in any way dig ourselves out in maybe the 20 minutes or the half an hour that remains. So let me take a sort of detour, if I could, that will address the issue that I'm raising a little bit obliquely. Buddhist teaching could, in some respect, be understood as a psychology in the way we Westerners talk about psychology. And this is a tack that I took in my book. A psychology that talks about the states of mind that change moment by moment, thoughts that arise and settle moment by moment. And from the point of view of Buddhist psychology, most of the thoughts that occur to us moment by moment are erroneous. They're based upon wrong notions of the phenomena we see. Wrong notions based upon this idea of phenomena having characteristics that are easily described in relationship to the phenomena and not dependent upon us. Phenomena are, by most of us, understood to be just as they appear, and nothing more than just as they appear. But from the point of view of the deepest Buddhist teaching, point of view of Nagarjuna's Madhyamaka, for example, phenomena are not what they appear. Our thoughts so color phenomena, our desires so color phenomena, so color our notions of ourselves that we can't see anything for what it really is. We only see our own minds projected into those phenomena. What we see those phenomena as being is independent of us, independent of their sources, independent of their causes, independent of their conditions that bring them about, independent of the labels that we place upon them. And all those notions are erroneous. According to Buddhist teaching, as I understand it, as Nagarjuna seems to teach about it, the real nature of phenomena is that they're completely dependent upon other causes outside of themselves. That phenomena and we ourselves are completely dependent upon certain conditions. This is what's usually referred to as dependent origination or dependent arising. That we see phenomena as separate and independent from each other is based upon the fact that we put names on phenomena. We name something as this, and therefore it's not that, and therefore it's not related to that other kind of thing. In so doing, we perpetuate over and over and over again are not understanding what's true. And in not understanding what's true, we find ourselves farther and farther in the muck, in confusion, in a mess. And let me give a specific example that I mentioned to Mel a little bit earlier. Something that Tara Rinpoche said a number of years ago on a snowy night in Amherst that woke me up to the truth of how we're all dependent on each other, and how phenomena, ourselves being the phenomena we're most concerned with, all depend upon other phenomena. It's one of those, I don't know if any of you have lived in the East, but it's one of those snowy nights where you're in a warm house and the evening begins pleasantly enough and the snow begins to fall and it gets heavier and the snow becomes heavier and the snow becomes heavier. Thank you, Blanche. I didn't realize it wasn't loud enough. The snow becomes heavier and heavier, and you begin realizing as you look out the windows that it's going to be hard going to get home. You know, you're going to have to scrape your car off. Will a car start? If you're walking, it's going to be problematic. And Rinpoche, in his inimical way of being right there and seeing what was happening as he was talking about dependent origination, and as people were being rather confused about what he meant, said, "Now look, when you leave here this evening, in order to get home, you're going to have to be walking down these streets which have been plowed by the snow plows, through sidewalks that have been shoveled by your friends, on roads that have been created by others. It's not possible for you to walk home except through the kindness of so many other people who built those roads, who shoveled those roads. As Mel says, when he turns on the tap and water comes out, he can drink that water because of the kindness of so many others who labored for that water to be there." And in this way, we're all totally interconnected and totally dependent upon each other. But we don't see that. Over and over again, we don't see that. And that's what the Buddha meant by ignorance. And what the teachings about dependent arising were about, and what the teachings about the selflessness of phenomena were about in somewhat more arcane or sophisticated way, was cutting through that ignorance to seeing directly how we're related to each other. Now, I started my little story talking about this artist that I'm meeting with and the sort of situation of our planet and the concerns that I'm hearing expressed over and over again. And how do these things relate? This is the concern that's uppermost for me. Because as I see how these things relate, and as the Buddha seems to be teaching how these things relate, and as even Noam Chomsky is aware of how these things relate, it's because of our not seeing how we are dependent upon each other and how our kindness to each other is what sustains us, But instead, because most of us go about seeing that our needs are paramount and our self-interest is paramount and we will take and not give back, that over the generations and the years, our societies and we have perpetuated and foisted this extraordinary situation upon this planet. By taking and not giving back, by our greed and self-centered action and not seeing how we are totally interconnected with each other and totally dependent upon the kindness of each other and the kindness of our planet, we've taken and not given. And now we're in this situation where the planet may have nothing to give back to us. And how do we turn this about? And mostly in Buddhist thought and in Buddhist practice, people believe that one meditates, one clears one's mind, one ceases thinking, and one can see directly what is and what is the truth. In Tibetan teaching, there's another little piece which is added to meditation practice and to the practice of how one lives in the world. And that other little piece is that while it's understood that wrong thought creates confusion and perpetuates ignorance, it's also understood that there's a possibility of right thought, and that right thought can be helpful. Right thought is the understanding, for example, of emptiness, the emptiness of phenomena. Right thought is the understanding of the dependent relationship of all phenomena and all of us with everything else. It's not said that right thought is truth with a capital T, because truth with a capital T is beyond thought. Because no matter how right a thought is or how accurate a thought is, still that thought stands between your essence or your consciousness and the phenomena and colors it. But still, there are right thoughts which are beneficial and helpful. And a right thought, such as our dependence on each other, is a beneficial and a helpful thought, which allows us to use our minds to establish a right relationship with each other, and to use our minds to establish a right relationship with our society and our planet. In the Tibetan tradition, it's called compassion. It's the way to be with each other, and it's based upon this right understanding of our dependence upon each other. So it seems to me that what we're all suffering from, and that what Noam Chomsky was talking about, was that we all need to begin to develop right thought about our dependence upon each other. Now, seems to me that although we may sit here and speak about dependent origination as right thought, our friends on the Bay Bridge trying to get home after a hard day at work are not going to be too interested in thinking about right thought, not in the way we think about it as Buddhists. My parents are interested in right thought, but they think about right thought as people raised in a Jewish tradition. The president of my university is interested in right thought, but he thinks about it in terms of humanitarian values. And if I sound too Buddhist, he starts getting a little bit nervous. To me, it's very important to find words and images that will fulfill the niche that right thought has filled in Buddhist societies in the past, in the niche that's needed to be filled in American society in the present. And so this brings me to, then, this evening's get-together with the artists. Because there are words and there are images. And when I think of the power of the images of two whales north of Alaska struggling to survive, and the Eskimos coming together, and the oil companies getting together, and the Russian icebreakers coming together to make a statement that we care. It's time for us to give back. It's time for us to start taking care of the planet. When I think of the power of those images on television over that week or week and a half, I think of the power of images in the culture. In thinking of this, I think of the power of a group of 22 artists getting together and thinking, how can we paint, how do we generate images of our worlds in harmony How do we send those images out into the world? And how, if we're really lucky, someone on Madison Avenue will steal those images, put those images on cereal boxes and on auto ads, and how the power of that will transform the world we live in, so that maybe the commuters on the Bay Bridge in the future will have a different attitude toward what they're doing. And maybe over time, the whole way in which we relate to this world will begin to shift. And to me, this is a totally Buddhist enterprise, perhaps in drag a little bit. But I think that that may be what's needed in the late 20th century in America. Finding ways for the Buddha Dharma to put on new clothes and not lose its identity, but permeate into a culture, into a society, into a world that needs it so desperately, and needs so desperately to understand how to live compassionately, and how to care for each other, and how to care for the planet. I think that's uppermost for us. And I'm so grateful that 2,500 years after the Buddha, we still have the opportunity to take his teaching and turn it to help all of us in this way. So I thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my little vision with you. There's some time for questions, I understand. So please, if there are any, I'd be glad.
I know very little about the mandala tradition within Tibetan Buddhism, but it sounds as if it's in the same area that mm-hmm. you just talked about. Can mm-hmm. you say something about that?
Well, mandalas, the word mandala is something that I think a lot of people may have heard, especially those that have done some reading in works by Carl Jung. Usually mandalas are understood to be circles with various images in them. In the Indian tradition, and in the Tibetan tradition, which arises in dependence upon it, mandalas are understood to be painted on paintings, but they're floor plans. They're floor plans of palaces or temples, if you will. And in that sense, and in that tradition, this hall itself is a mandala. It's a mandala, and this hall, in this tantric tradition, is understood as an enclosure, a place for change to happen, for transformation to happen. And sometimes I think of the mandala as being like almost a three-dimensional, and reorient yourself to that space and reorient yourself in your relationship to the world around you and in relationship to your own nature. That's my understanding of that's what the practice of the mandala imagery is about. And again, I would see it as very intimately related to the work of the artists who may not understand themselves as painting mandalas, but I think understand themselves as painting images which will change the experience of the viewer to help the viewer reorient themselves in time and space and in relationship to the world. So I think of this as a tradition that carries on, known or unknown. Yes.
Thank you for your talk. And could you give me your ideas about people who have an idea for peace and harmony in the world, and say this group of 22 artists, the foundation of where they're coming from is just their own experience. If it's a meditation base and the experience from that and putting it onto canvas or on pottery. And people who have other or no basis for their idea being just an idea, say people in politics who are, at least from my point of view, not really demonstrating ideas for peace and harmony. And what, as you said, on the Bay Bridge going across, perhaps the people who have these really hard lines, not so harmonious views on how we can have peace in the world, would hear something on the radio or see a billboard that these artists will have produced, will make them start thinking. But what about the people who don't happen to see those billboards and are looking through newspapers or what have you?
Well, it's the reason why I said I hope Madison Avenue will steal all the images. Because, you know, in our popular culture, if an image catches on, like the fins of the cars of the 1950s, they go everywhere. I mean, that's the power of popular culture. It's also the horror of popular culture. And perhaps like judo, my sense is you take the horror and you use it to your advantage. The media is so potent and so powerful in this country and so hypnotic in its abilities to enforce ideologies unconsciously that I hold great hope for subterfuge through the media. And to try and back up to the beginning of your question, though, I think that what this group of artists will be trying to do, and I say I think because we're just entering into the process, is something that's a little on the unique side, in that each of them is rather solitary in their own practice as an artist, tends to have a somewhat contemplative, often, background, whether it's Christian or Buddhist or simply as a painter. But in bringing them together, and bringing them together every couple of weeks in our home to drink some wine and have some conversation, we're forming a sangha of artists in a certain way. And I think just as there's a potency of our all gathering in the Zendo to meditate, which augments our practice, so there's a potency of bringing the artists together in our version of the Zendo, in our living room, to share something. When they paint, they'll paint on their own. But their inspiration will come from being together. And the images for each of them, I'm sure, will be completely different. There's a woman in the group whose work I see as a direct descendant of the Russian Orthodox Christian tradition. There's a woman in the group who paints sort of Caucasian versions of bodhisattvas and dakinis. And there's someone in the group who paints skyscapes, unusual arrangements of stars, things you would see if you were in a spaceship. And there's tremendous diversity in what people do. But in being together and working on this theme, my hope is, and I think their hope is also, that the sort of critical mass of all these people being together will help generate something new, that will tap into something deeper than what exists in any one individual. And when we all get together and share what those images finally are, who knows what we're going to see? Who knows if there'll be any commonality or not? I don't know if anyone's really tried this before, and it is very experimental. But if imagery is going to be found which is going to transform how we relate to each other, it has to be imagery that comes out of group experience in some way. It has to share something about group, about sangha. And I don't know any other way to bring this about. So I have great hope. And if it's successful, then what comes out of the group will resonate with the larger group in a way in which no single individual's images probably could ever do. It seems to me that the power of traditional Buddhist imagery is the fact that it has accumulated over time, that the images have been honed and shaped and worked by countless beings over thousands of years now. And if the images represent something that's very deeply shared in their experience, and therefore in the experience in all of us. And so in this way, in this little microcosmic way, I think we're attempting to do something similar. And then we share it, the conference. And since this is a 20th century conference, a late 20th century conference, we'll have television cameras there, and there'll be music, And the music and the things seen by the cameras, the speakers and the images picked up by the cameras will be broadcast over satellite networks all over the globe. So who knows? I guess the important point is that, maybe not to directly answer your question, but the important point is there's so much despair. And people are so unsure of what to do. And if we do look to our leaders and we say, where are the positive notions of peace? We never find them. Someplace those things exist. Someplace they can be tapped. And I think most deeply in our own hearts is where they'll be tapped. And any little piece that helps is a little piece that helps. Yes?
David, as you were talking a lot, images and the work of the artists, and also the idea of right thought or putting that out in the way of an image. I couldn't help thinking about Joseph Campbell and some of his teachings of mythology and the connection, especially in the idea of images. His thoughts that we need new images or mythology to live by.
Mm-hmm.
And the one in particular that he thought was connectedness, shows the connectedness of man, was the image of Earth that we saw since the astronauts took that photo back in from the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also mentioned the whales.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a lot to say about the mythology of whales. And how the idea, if a particular thought is, the image is pictured in someone like, say, Madison Avenue, gets a hold of it, the impact it could have.
It's profound.
So I mentioned that the connection came to me.
Well, you know, Stuart Brand also wrote about the power of that image of the Earth floating in the sky. I shouldn't say the sky, in space. And the direct sense of the fragility of this thin shell of life on the Earth, and of the vast space around us that seems so lifeless. Brand said he thought that when that image went out over the media, everything changed. From that moment on, everything changed for many people, because really we saw it. I think he was right. I do. I think it must have changed for Campbell, but I think he must have been incredibly ripe for it to change, too. Thank you.